From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the report on PFAS safety levels in water the EPA didn't want us to see. It's out.
We definitely think that the EPA advisory level is too high to be health protective.
Going back 75 years ago this day to the Detroit race riot.
They are attacking the streetcars, pulling African Americans off and beating them, and of course, in some cases, killing them.
Getting beehives into Detroit's urban farms and gardens.
Scientists say that you get up to 70% higher yield if there's a beehive within a 2-mile radius of your garden.
And we'll head up to Grayling for a preview of this weekend's Sticky Buns Days.
We were sitting around 22 years ago deciding, you know, maybe we ought to have a festival of some kind, and somebody said, well, let's make sticky buns.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The three top Democratic candidates for governor debated last night on Wood TV in Grand Rapids. Shri Tanadar, Gretchen Whitmer, and Dr. Abdul El-Sayed had 1 hour to make their case to voters. We had one candidate presenting himself as an immigrant success story, another as the son of immigrants, and the third is the only one with experience in governing. With us now is Adrian Hammond, who's Democratic political strategist with Grassroots Midwest. Adrian, let's start with broad strokes. Did anything or anyone surprise you last night?
No, I thought the none of the candidates really stood out or moved the ball downfield a lot from their performance at the debate up on Mackinac Island. I thought they all performed credibly. I wouldn't say that anybody added a ton of value to their candidacy last night, but there were some interesting developments.
All right. Well, let's start with that. Now, first of all, where did you hear the main areas where they were all three pretty much in agreement?
Yeah, I think they were largely in agreement about things. There wasn't much in the way of policy difference. It was all really about framing and sort of making the case to Democratic primary voters that they were the person that could get the job done. But there really wasn't a whole lot of policy daylight between the three candidates.
All right, when you talk about interesting developments, such as?
One of the things that interested me the most from the debate last night was the performance of Dr. El-Sayed. And he's running third in the polls right now. I don't know that he did a ton to improve the chances of his candidacy, but throughout the debate last night, you kept seeing this raw political talent bubble to the surface. And sometimes he really connected with his answers, and sometimes he was right on the cusp of doing it. But I spent a lot of time watching the debate last night thinking about what might have been if either Dr. El-Sayed had run for something else first to get a little bit more practice at being a political candidate. You know, his candidacy had started before the whole contremps with Congressman John Conyers, but I think Dr. El-Sayed could have won the 13th Congressional District running away. He would have had to move back into the district, but he's a very talented young politician.
Well, let's listen to tone. We're going to start by listening to hear some moments where there was some disagreement and separation, as you say, in the framing between the candidates. We're going to start by listening to Gretchen Whitmer and Dr. El-Sayed. They were talking about health care and the battle for the ideological heart of the Democratic Party in Michigan. Here is Gretchen Whitmer.
When Governor Snyder embraced Medicaid expansion, I went to work and I partnered with him and we delivered. And so I'm the only person on this stage that's actually delivered on providing health care for people. Yes, we still have 600,000 people in our state that we need to expand coverage to, and I am absolutely committed to that. Here's the thing that sets me apart. I know how to get things done.
And here's Dr. El-Sayed.
In this race, I am the only candidate here who has fully complied with federal financial disclosures. I'm not taking a dime of corporate money. We are knocking on 10,000 doors a week, and we are having conversations with voters about real policy. Because I'm not bought off by the folks like Blue Cross Blue Shield. I can say single-payer health care. I'm not bought off by the auto insurance companies. I'll talk about insurance reform. It's about what Michiganders deserve in their politics.
Now, remind us again, Adrian, why Dr. El-Sayed keeps going out of his way to talk about not being beholden to Blue Cross Blue Shield?
Well, I mean, Blue Cross Blue Shield has made some contributions to, executives at Blue Cross Blue Shield have made some contributions to Senator Whitmer's campaign. I know at least one Blue Cross executive has, hosted a fundraiser for her. So I think that's sort of what Dr. El-Sayed's trying to get at, is to differentiate himself as the sort of outsider candidate who doesn't have these relationships with, you know, large health insurers, folks like that. I think that in order for him to really land that attack, he would have to be more explicit about it. He didn't mention Senator Whitmer once, anytime that he brought up Blue Cross Blue Shield.
So you'd really kind of have to kind of go into the weeds and know these things the way you do to kind of to have that hit land.
Absolutely, yeah. If he wants to use that, and it's probably a good political attack for him, he's got to be much more explicit about it.
Now, Whitmer was the only candidate of the three who did not mention single-payer health care. I'm wondering, how much is her stance on health care an issue in this primary?
You know, I don't think that it's a huge issue. I mean, my feeling about partisan primaries, whether it's this primary for governor or any other in any party, is once you meet the issue test, the primary voters know that you stand with them on the issues that are most important to them, then it's a popularity contest. And so these primaries, you know, policy detail is important, but it's not that important. All of these candidates are basically in the same place, regardless of the particulars of how they get there. They want to expand health care coverage to everyone in Michigan. They have slightly different ideas about how to do that. That's basically what Democratic primary voters want to see. They want to see health care coverage expanded. So at that point, it really becomes a personality contest. Who do you believe actually has the chops to get the job done?
Now, the very second question of the debate was about the roads, everybody's favorite topic in Michigan. And both Whitmer and Dr. El-Sayed talked about their plans for an infrastructure bank. But Sri Tanadar has a different approach. Let's take a listen.
We got to fix the roads. We got to fix our infrastructure. I am proposing a $30 billion, 30-year municipal statewide bond to pay for our infrastructure. We need to put about $4 billion taking care of the lead pipes. We need to take care of the bridges that are falling apart. We need to have mass transportation. People need to be able to drive all across and go. The bus routes need to be increased. We need to have light rail. We need to take Michigan to the next level.
So, infrastructure bank or this statewide municipal bond, do you think primary voters, either one of those approaches might resonate with them?
I mean, frankly, I think that most primary voters don't understand the difference between the two of those things or exactly what the candidates are talking about. They want to hear that folks have got a plan to do this. Most primary voters don't understand how the bond markets work, which is probably a fortunate thing for Mr. Tanadar, since he referred to these as municipal bonds and they're not. I don't think that that matters that much. I think that folks want to know that you have a plan and they want to be able to trust that you've got the chops to get the job done. But that's what they're electing you for. They shouldn't have to understand bond markets or how you're going to finance the plan more broadly than who's going to pay for it.
Adrian, do you think overall any of those three delivered anything that might convert voters in a state that went for Donald Trump in 2016?
I mean, nothing that they said in this debate for that was, you know, aimed squarely at Democratic primary voters is going to change a lot of minds for the general electorate. I did think it was interesting. You know, I've been harping on for a long time, one of the things that Democrats have gotten really bad at and helps to explain their electoral fortunes in 2016 is making the argument of what do you, Mr. or Mrs. Voter, get when I win. Hillary Clinton was terrible at that. The candidates last night, each of them sort of tiptoed up to that. I thought that notwithstanding that I didn't think he gave a great performance last night, I think actually Sri Tanadar came the closest to that. His closing statement was all about, imagine what happens after I win, this thing, that thing, and listed off a specific list of things of what do you get when I win. And I think that that's each of the candidates tried to do that. I think that in his closing statement, Mr. Tanadar probably came the closest. I don't think overall he gave the best performance of the three candidates last night, but he really did do the best job of any of the candidates right at the end of making that tie. What do you, Mr. or Mrs. Voter, get when I win?
Now, I've got to ask you about Detroit area voters. We certainly know that was, a terrible wound and a weakness for the turnout in the 2016 election. Are any of these candidates gaining traction in the state's largest city? And how much of an issue is that, both in the primary and even more importantly in the general election?
I mean, it's a huge issue in both the primary and the general election. And I would say that none of the three candidates has done a great job. Each of them has a very different strategy for sort of getting into the city of Detroit. I would say that right now you'd have to give a slight advantage in terms of the execution of those strategies to Sri Tanadar, largely because for all of his posturing as an outsider business candidate. He's running a very traditional Detroit program. He's bringing in pastors, some of them on a paid basis, and other community leaders to help him organize in the city of Detroit, in addition to all the money that he's spending on television ads. So, I mean, there's certainly been, money and influence changing hands down there with some of the traditional Democratic power brokers. And he doesn't have the union support, so he's had to go to some other areas to get that. I think that, candidate Whitmer has been relying a lot on the unions that have endorsed her, and she's really racked up all of the important union endorsements to date to help her in the city of Detroit with their membership, and that can also be very powerful. I think she needs to do a better job, a more aggressive job of executing in the city of Detroit and really engendering not just support but enthusiasm. In 2016, if you asked the average Detroit voter if they preferred Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, they would certainly tell you Hillary Clinton, but a lot of those folks didn't show up because the enthusiasm wasn't there, and I think that's her task. I've been surprised, frankly, at how poorly Dr. El-Sayed has performed in Detroit, given the fact that he led the health department there. But a lot of the voters that he's targeting, sort of far-left Bernie-crat voters, those are in general not Detroit voters.
Can you call a winner last night?
I would give a very slight advantage to candidate Whitmer. I said at the beginning that I didn't think anybody helped their candidacy a ton. I think if anybody did, it was Senator Whitmer. She had the most balanced performance last night. Sri Tanadar took a lot of big swings in terms of big ideas. His delivery was a little bit stilted, but like I mentioned before, he had a really good closing argument. I think that Senator Whitmer was on a really even keel throughout the night. She was polished and professional. She didn't add anything particularly new that we haven't heard in her stump speech or in prior debate performances, but I think she was the most sort of professional candidate. Like I mentioned earlier, Dr. El-Sayed is just brimming with political talent. And I spent a lot of the time when I was listening to him thinking about what might have been. I think he gave a very credible performance last night. He's running so far behind in the polls, I don't think he's got much chance to prevail, but I'll be very excited to see what he does with that talent in the future.
Democratic political strategist Adrian Hammond with Grassroots Midwest. Adrian, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
Coming up, we've had the fortune of hosting a Russian journalist in the Michigan Radio newsroom for the past couple of weeks. She'll join us to share thoughts on Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, and explain what it's like to work at an independent news organization in Russia. Plus, she'll offer some first impressions of Michigan. That's after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan Radio has been hosting a visiting journalist from Russia for the past couple of weeks. Ekaterina Silvanova works for the online television station Duge in Moscow. With Russia being so prominent in the news lately, we asked her to go out and speak with some Americans and share her thoughts about the relationship between Russia and the United States.
The cultural divide between Russia and America can seem wide sometimes. Like when American President Donald Trump told G7 leaders that Crimea was part of Russia because most of its population speaks Russian. Please don't tell Trump how much of the Russian population speaks English.
So where are you from? You have an accent. Oh, you are from Russia.
To try to understand that divide better, I went to the streets of Ann Arbor to ask Americans what they think of the relationships between our countries.
American institutions are being attacked by this guy, Trump, and Putin is sitting back there smiling, and man, I don't even have to do any work. He's doing it for me.
They don't bother me, I don't bother them, but I mean, everyone has a free right to talk and do what they want to do and grow their economy.
A lot of countries have tension with America, so they could be one of many. I would love to go to Russia to visit. I've never been out the country, so it's actually one of the spots I would like to go to.
I think people-to-people relationships are growing all over the world, probably because of the internet and so on. And I think that gets young people moving more in a uniting sort of fashion than pointing fingers.
Recently, Politico published a poll showing that Special Counsel Robert Mueller's public image has sunk to all-time low since he began his probe into possible collusion between the Trump presidential campaign and Russia. But still, 7 in 10 adults support the investigation into possible collusion with Russia.
He is quite a straightforward guy, and he's actually a Republican, so it's not like he's favoring one side over the other. I mean, he's head of the FBI, so he knows how to do it.
Seems pretty meticulous, because I've definitely heard a lot of details come out, and it's taken over a year at this point, which is not a wildly long time, but considering the potential consequences, is a lot of time to wait to get any sort of results.
Russia is probably looking for their own interest, and they probably have something that they get out of it. We've been kind of enemies with them for a really long time, since like the Cold War. There's probably a bargain in there.
Russia has interests or objectives that's different than a lot of other countries. I think for the most part, Trump aligns naturally with a lot of those objectives.
Russian audiences seem much more interested in Trump than Americans are in Putin. Last year, leading Russian TV channels mentioned Trump several times more often than Vladimir Putin. However, after a number of sanctions were placed on Russia by the United States, the number of Russians supporting Trump fell from 63% to 18%. There are no polls in Russia on Mueller on his investigation. Obviously, there are people who do and don't believe that Russia meddled in United States elections. A great deal of Mueller's investigation concentrates on the possibility that Russians manipulated public opinion through Facebook ads. If Russians were behind it, there must have been an order from their tech-savvy authorities. But are there tech-savvy authorities in Russia? Remember, this is the same country that recently blocked its most promising internet project, Telegram messaging app. The app is largely focused on providing security, which made it popular in countries like Iran. Russian courts blocked Telegram after the company refused to hand over encryption keys, which keep data from the app secure by scrambling it. The problem is that every encryption key is designed with algorithms and is unique, so it's impossible to hand them over. Clearly, Russian authorities don't know much about the internet. Both Russians and Americans remain unsure if meddling happened, but if authorities admit this possibility, it seems scary that the presidential election could be undermined by something as silly as Facebook ads. If it is true, how stable is American democracy, or really any democracy? For Michigan Radio, I am Ekaterina Silvanova.
Katya Silvanova is here with us now. It's great to have you with us, Katya.
Hi, thank you very much for having me here.
Now, you're on an exchange program that brought you to us here at Michigan Radio. What were you hoping to get out of working here for these couple of weeks?
American journalism, I think, is very different from Russian journalism. I mean, not even ideologically, but also from the technical side, it's very different. And for me, being on the radio is a unique experience because back in Russia, I work on a TV station and I mostly work for our website. So for me, editing the sound and all this stuff connected to radio was very new.
Now, how much did you know ahead of time about Michigan? I'm wondering what you thought you would find.
Actually, what I knew was all connected to Detroit and bankruptcy of this city. So I thought that Michigan could be very depressed and not economically stable. And I was very surprised to see a very cute little town of Ann Arbor. So I thought maybe it's even smaller and even more depressed than Detroit. But then I was surprised.
And then did you get to Detroit?
Yeah, I've been to Detroit once. I visited only the city center, so I could see all these skyscrapers and a baseball game. So I didn't see any sign of depression, but I'll have a chance to go to Detroit one more time. So I hope I can see the 8 Mile and all the areas that are not so wealthy. So I think my impression could be changed.
Well, what were some of your first impressions when you got here to Michigan? I mean, I'm wondering what really stood out to you, good and bad. Be honest now.
Oh, I think that it's my first introduction to like real America, because before that I visited the United States only once. I was in New York for Christmas holidays. And the thing that I was surprised most of all were like dead animals on the roadsides.
Roadkill. Yes.
And
yeah.
Everyone here on Michigan radio, they're like laughing about that, because I was really surprised because I saw a dead deer laying on the roadside and I was like, oh my God, what is it doing here? And then I saw plenty of different animals there. And I cannot imagine this happening in Russia, because if a car hits the deer, the driver is probably like, oh my God, I have a dinner now. And of course, we don't eat like cats and dogs, but still, like the deer sounds like a good dinner.
So that surprised you. What other impressions?
I was surprised how much plastic is consumed here. Every time I come to any cafe or restaurant, they give me free water and they just put the straws in it. Like, I didn't even ask for that. I know that some of the cafes who present themselves as eco-friendly, they put some compostable straws, but I think it's a little bit like consumer behavior stuff, because if you want to use compostable straws, you have to have compost on your backyard, which probably most people don't have.
And they take those straws and throw them right into the trash.
That goes into
it. And I know in the EU there are movements toward outlawing the plasticware and the plastic straws. So it certainly seems like the other side of the Atlantic is ahead of us in that.
Yeah, I mean, in Russia we even have a joke about Russians who have a plastic bag for all the plastic bags in the house. And like it was a very good joke for Russians, really, you know, showing our poverty maybe 10 years ago, because some people, they even washed the plastic bags to reuse them. So that time we were like laughing, ha ha ha, look, we are so poor that we even have to wash our plastic bags. But now I see it was not so bad.
Yes. I want to pivot a little bit, Katya. How do you and your colleagues in the Russian news media view President Trump?
Oh, you know, President Trump was a very big figure in Russian media when he won the elections. I saw some statistics showing that President Trump was even more popular than President Putin at that time. So Russian media mentioned him way more often than Putin, which is almost impossible because Putin is like the main character in all the news every time. So lots of people who were having some patriotic feelings for Russia, they were very happy that Donald Trump won the elections. Of course, it was like very unexpected of us, because usually when you're working in a newsroom, you always have plan A and plan B what to do. But I would say that no one really expected Trump to win, and we didn't even have, you know, plan B for covering that. I was not a part of TV Dosht at that time. I worked for another station, but I woke up in the morning like completely astonished by what happened because we didn't even expect that. So we didn't have any plan B of what to do. So yeah, lots of people who were like patriotic at first, they thought, oh my God, we're going to be friends with United States. But then things changed and I don't think that anyone thinks that Trump is going to be doing all this stuff to become friends with Putin.
You explored in your report that we just heard, you talked to Americans about their thoughts on the conversation and the ongoing investigation into Russian meddling in our 2016 election. What are your thoughts about that?
You know, we have a troll factory in St. Petersburg, which is very much focused on different activity in the internet to like meddle into every process. Not only, you know, elections, something as big as election, but they also keep an eye on every publication we have. For example, if we upload new video to YouTube, they're the ones who will be there first to put all the dislikes and to try to undermine this publication. So our TV channel was the first one who found the person who worked in a foreign outlet of this troll factory. So now he lives in Thailand and he works there as a something connected to computer science. And he said that they were trying to change the attitude of Americans toward the elections. And they were doing some pornographic videos with a person that reminds of Hillary Clinton a little bit. So it was like a huge campaign, but it's still unclear who was the one who gave the order for this troll factory to start this kind of activity. Because as I said in my report, Russian government seems not very aware of what is internet and how internet works, because you should be very technical savvy to realize how Facebook ads could meddle into election, how they could undermine this process.
In final moments, how will you describe Michigan when you get back to your colleagues in the newsroom in Moscow?
I would say that this area is very green, very attractive, and it's full of people who like to get pleasure of life. I mean, you're traveling everywhere, you're traveling up north, and you really enjoy this small moments of going somewhere. I was surprised how people are proud of their own houses, how they like this, like their own street, and every house is full of, you know, even political signs. Like, we want to stand for this mayor, we want to support this Muslim community, and I love it because it's like a small protest in front of your house, and it shows that you're really proud of the place where you live.
Katya Selivanova, thank you for being with us, and it was great to have you with us at Michigan Radio.
Thank you so much.
What are we going to do?
Road trip.
You bet. And summertime in Michigan means lots of different festivals to explore. Now, some like the National Asparagus Festival in Oceana County, they're pretty self-explanatory. Others, however, are just a little more quirky. And who doesn't like a little quirkiness in their summer festival? Take Sticky Buns Days, for instance, happening this weekend in Grayling at Wellington Farm USA. Howard Taylor is the general manager there. Howard, this is a 60-acre living history farm.
It's a 60-acre living history farm dedicated to the preservation of life as it was lived in a rural Midwestern farming community during the Great Depression, more specifically the year 1932.
And why focus on Depression-era farming?
I don't know. We just kind of stumbled onto that, and it looked like a neat thing to do because nobody else was doing it. And so 22 years ago, we decided that's what we're going to do, and we started out with one building and a sawmill, and now we're up to 26 buildings in here.
You know, and you're absolutely right. When you think of living history, we often think, 1700s, 1800s. So really interesting that you're focusing on 1932. So how does Sticky Buns Days, how does that fit into this focus in the Depression era?
Well, Sticky Buns Day started out as kind of a fluke. We were sitting around 22 years ago deciding, you know, maybe we ought to have a festival of some kind, and somebody said, well, let's make sticky buns. And so we said, okay, we're going to make sticky buns, and we called it Sticky Buns Day, and we've been doing it now every year for 22 years, and it's one of our biggest festivals.
And when you say make it, you really mean make it, right? I mean, you are starting from
the
beginning.
We really mean make it. We mean the products to manufacture the sticky buns comes from right here on the farm. And we make them from scratch, and we bake them in the oven of a wood-fired cook stove in our summer kitchen.
Now, I have to ask you, when I think of sticky buns, am I thinking of something, you know, like a big cinnamon bun? I mean, describe it to us.
It's a cinnamon roll that has nuts in it and is covered with sticky stuff.
And it sounds good, but am I correct that people can't actually eat the sticky buns you're going to be making this weekend?
Well, let's put it this way. We cannot offer them for sale. We cannot encourage people to eat them, but what we do is we bake them, and they watch us make them. They watch us bake them. They smell them while they're baking in the oven. And then when we get them out of the oven and they're cooled down a little bit, we cut them into bite-sized pieces and set them on the table. And if people snitch them, there's nothing we can do about that.
It strikes me that you could probably get some folks who are seniors but who could say, you know, I kind of remembered this being, you know, my mom's farm or my grandma's farm. Do you get that kind?
Oh, we get lots of those.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Well, senior citizens love the place because, you know, it's nostalgic for them. It takes them back to a time that they can remember. And we get lots and lots of comments going, oh, I remember my dad doing that, or, oh, we had one of those things on our farm, and we hear that all the time. But on the other side of the coin, we get younger people coming in, and they're actually astonished at how innovative and creative the people of the Great Depression were, because they had to be creative in order to exist.
That is so true. Give us an idea. What do you grow, and what animals do you keep at Wellington Farm USA?
Oh, we keep a variety of animals, and they come and go. Right now, we've got a llama, we've got some goats, we've got some sheep, we got a pot-bellied pig, we got a few chickens, we got a team of horses. And they're all in the livestock barn, and the kids can go in and see them, and they like that. But we grow all of the things that would have been typical on a typical 1932 small farm.
See, you put this 60-acre living history farm to very, very good use, Howard.
Oh, yeah, we farm every bit of it. And, of course, we have about 15 to 20 acres of forested area also. So we have some really neat nature trails that people can walk. One of the comments that we get a lot of is, man, it's so peaceful out here. And it is. It's peaceful and quiet, and the serenity of the surroundings are great. The ambiance is great. It's a great place to come to. We have been accused of being Northern Michigan's best-kept secret.
Well, there we go. Best-kept secret no more. Now the stateside audience knows about Wellington Farm USA near Grayling. We've been talking to General Manager Howard Taylor, and thank you so much for letting us in on Northern Michigan's best-kept secret, Howard.
You're very welcome, and we hope to see you in the very near future.
And you can find more about Sticky Buns Days happening this Saturday and Sunday and all the other activities at Wellington Farm USA. Just go to our website at michiganradio.org. Coming up, we'll find out what's in the federal government's long-anticipated report on health effects of the chemical family known as PFAS. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A report on the dangers of PFAS exposure that had been suppressed by the EPA and Scott Pruitt and others in Washington has been released. PFAS is a family of chemicals that's often used in making products non-stick or waterproof and used in firefighting foam. And they've been found at high levels in people's drinking water across the state. Here with us now is Alexis Temkin, a toxicologist at the Environmental Working Group in Washington, which focuses on public health. Great to have you with us, Alexis. Thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So fill us in on the recent weeks. Where did this report come from? And why was it that the EPA, the Defense Department, and the White House wanted to keep it private?
Sure. So this report is released by ATSDR, which is a group within the Center for Disease Control, CDC. And their main job is to provide toxicological profiles or assessments of different types of chemicals. In this case, we were looking at perfluorinated chemicals, two in particular most people familiar with are PFOA and PFOS. And there were emails back and forth that came out in some FOIA releases that indicated the data that would be presented in this release was going to identify safe levels of these chemicals that were lower than values that the EPA had previously reported in 2016 when they did their own assessment of these chemicals.
In fact, as I recall, this report was somewhere in all those emails, it was characterized as a public relations nightmare.
Yes, I do remember seeing that as well.
Okay, so now that we have this report, all 852 pages of it, what is in it? What does it boil down to?
So the biggest conclusion that does come from this report is looking at what are considered the minimal risk levels that ATSDR presents for PFOA and PFOS. And when you compare those levels to reference dose levels that were presented by the EPA in the 2016 report, we see that the concentrations considered safe by ATSDR are actually 7 to 10-fold lower than what the EPA had reported.
So the EPA had been saying its lifetime health advisory for PFAS was 70 parts per trillion?
That's correct.
And what is this report, just to put it into numbers for us? So what does this report recommend lowering that level to?
Sure. So in the report itself, it's important to sort of clarify that ATSDR doesn't actually set drinking water guidelines, but when you can take their data that they've presented and translate it into drinking water guidelines in a method that the EPA used in their reports, you see that for PFAS, an acceptable level would be around 7 parts per trillion, and for PFOA, an acceptable level would be around 11 parts per trillion.
That's quite a difference from 70 parts per trillion. That is, I'm sure, going to catch people's attention. So how are other scientists or state and local officials, existing PFAS committees, how are they reacting to this report?
You know, I think we know that other states previously have already set certain regulatory limits that are lower than the 70 parts per trillion for that the EPA set. So you see definitely support of having lower levels from a regulatory standpoint. I know EWG and other academic scientists have mentioned and talked about how we think the safe drinking level is probably more like 1 parts per trillion based on some human evidence looking at immunotoxicity in children.
But I guess if you look at the original health advisory level then from the EPA, what I'm hearing from you is that that is way too high based on the science that's contained in this report.
Sure. We definitely think that the EPA advisory level is too high to be health protective, especially for really sensitive and vulnerable populations like children and during pregnancy when you have development occurring.
So, Alexis, we've got this 852-page report. It says that really safe levels are drastically lower than what the EPA is recommending. So what do we do with these recommendations? Can we expect any changes in these findings?
Sure. So I'm not sure if this report is really going to elicit changing at the federal level, but it definitely bolsters support for states taking initiative, which we've already seen, to set enforceable drinking water standards that are lower than the 70 parts per trillion health advisory. I think this report also really urges EPA to release all testing data that they have from drinking water where they've detected any level of PFAS contamination so that we really can get a broader picture of what contamination might look like in drinking water. And then families can really take steps to either use water filtration or sort of organization within the community to really protect their families from the PFAS contamination.
Yeah, you know, when I think about what we saw play out in Flint with the water crisis there, and then now we have a number of locations around Michigan where people are worried about this family of chemicals in their water. So if I'm worried about that in my water, what does this report mean to me?
Well, I think we've seen in terms of perhaps success stories where we think about PFAS regulation, a lot of community organization to get things done. But I think you can definitely use this report to engage with other people in your community, legislators, the people that are in charge of regulations. It also can inform you whether or not you might want to consider using a water filter.
I hear a lot of talk from you. It seems to be the emphasis is on local and state action. Is the Scott Pruitt Trump-led EPA, is that showing any leadership in dealing with this problem?
Definitely the release of their drinking water advisory was a step in the right direction. But as we can see with this report, we have, you know, new data that really suggests taking action to protect human health from these chemicals is something that needs to be done. The health guideline advisories aren't enforceable by EPA, and we really have seen states start to step up to actually protect their drinking water for their citizens.
Alexis Temkin is a toxicologist with the Environmental Working Group in Washington. It focuses on public health. Alexis, thanks for speaking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It may be tiny, but a honeybee is a powerful force for good in our environment. And that's why Brian Peterson is on a personal mission to get as many of us as he can to appreciate, support, and better yet, even keep honeybees. Brian is an elementary school teacher in Rochester and the founder of Bees in the D, and he is with us now. Brian Peterson, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Great to be here.
What is the mission of Bees in the D?
So our main mission is just the education and conservation of honeybees. As simple as that.
And you're a busy elementary school teacher with a lot on your plate. What led you to this gig pushing honeybees?
So it's kind of a fun story. I'll keep it concise for you, but about 10 years ago, I got a call from the science coordinator in Rochester Community Schools saying that the Women's Garden Club of Rochester would like to sponsor a school teacher to go up to Beaver Island to the Biological Center up there and take a 2-week crash course on beekeeping. And I was like, where do I sign? And took the trip up there over the summer. I caught the bug and then started to get my own hives in Lake Orion when I lived there. And we eventually really were excited about what was going on in Detroit. And so my now husband and I moved down to Detroit and bought a loft on the river. And I thought my beekeeping days were done because I was like, well, now I'm in the city.
Yes.
I'll keep a couple hives up north. But then I was taking a vacation in New York City. I was at Battery Park. Mm-hmm. And literally like 3 feet away from me, here are beehives right in the middle of this public park. And I thought, wait a second. If they can do that, why can't I in Detroit? And so we decided to start our nonprofit called Bees in the D.
And the mission is to get as many beehives throughout the city as you can.
Yeah, and to educate, because mm-hmm. Bees kind of get a bum rap, you know?
A lot of misconceptions, right?
A lot of misconceptions, because most of the flying insects that annoy us are wasps and hornets. They're not even bees. And the honeybee kind of gets the blame. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to be a voice for the bee, and I owe the bees that much because beekeeping actually came into my life at a time when I was really struggling, and it became my—I call it my yoga. It relaxes me. I go in the hives. It just calms me down.
We're talking about benefits that go beyond, hey, I have an access to honey.
Right.
Was there some aha moment when you realized what bees could mean for gardens and growing food?
Totally. I had a pretty large garden in Lake Orion, and I got a fair amount of vegetables, but I actually was one of those garden nerds that went out with a paintbrush, and especially my zucchini and some of my tomatoes and cucumbers, I would pollinate it with the brush because the flowers were falling off because no pollinators were pollinating them. And so I ended up getting the beehives and put my paintbrush away. I had so many vegetables. I learned to pickle. I learned to jar. I learned to make everything known to man out of zucchini because I had so much. I couldn't give it away fast enough. Scientists say that you get up to 70% higher yield if there's a beehive within a 2-mile radius of your garden.
So here you are, kind of the Jenny Appleseed of bees, going around trying to get people to keep a hive. How do you find the folks who are willing to say, all right, forget these misconceptions about stinging and whatever, I'll keep a hive? How do you find them?
Sometimes it just takes a little education.
Okay.
One of the best ways is to suit people up and actually take them into a hive. It's so interesting. I talk to people before we go, what they are thinking is going to happen, what their preconceptions are. And they're like, oh, the bees are going to be all over us. And then I talk to them after and they're like, that's it? I mean, I don't even feel like we needed the bee suit. People realize, wow, these are really docile creatures that just are doing their thing.
What can people do who perhaps don't want to go all the way and have an actual hive, but what could they do in their own yards to help support bees?
I'm so glad you asked that, because we are starting an initiative right now called the Bee Highway. And what we would like to help happen is, because not everybody, a hive isn't for everybody. Mm-hmm. It's a responsibility. It's a lot of work. So some people can help out just by planting more bee-friendly plants.
Such as?
Lavender. A lot of the herbs are wonderful. Any of the flowers, you know, the wildflowers. And then the other thing is just let some of the flowers grow. It's okay to have dandelions in your yard. It's okay to let that little area kind of go wild or plant some wildflowers there. And then the other thing that's so important for bees is water, believe it or not. They use the water for not only their to air condition their hive, which is a whole nother thing. They need it to, you know, for nourishment. If you have a water feature, you're in great shape because it can go right up to the edge. But a lot of people get a small bird bath and they put rocks or marbles or in it so that they have a landing area and they can get the water. And so that's a great way to help support them as well.
And when you say bee highway, what is that going to be?
So I kind of look at it like, I don't know if you remember a while ago, the bluebirds, their numbers were declining. And it was because other birds were taking their nesting areas. And so along the Michigan highways, what they did is they put up birdhouses every half a mile or every mile or so. And their population just started to soar again because they had places to nest. So it's a kind of a similar feel. It doesn't necessarily have to be along the highway, mm-hmm. but throughout neighborhoods. But we are looking to talk with MDOT and others to why not use along the highways? Look at all that beautiful space along the side of the roads where we could grow wildflowers and make it a bee-friendly area.
Now, I have to ask, as people have hives and those hives produce honey, what do they do with the honey?
So honey is kind of that bonus. We always share with people that we're not in the honey business, but we do get honey and we do sell it, but we like to do it in a unique way. We actually do a live honey harvest so that people can learn how to harvest the honey, and then they get to jar up their own honey so they're a part of the experience. It doesn't get fresher than that when you're like jarring it up right there and on the spot. So a lot of people that are beekeepers just keep the honey for themselves. They make great gifts. Everybody loves fresh honey. And if you do produce enough honey, you can sell it, and it does produce a little bit of money, and that money that we get goes back to the nonprofit organization.
Brian Peterson, Bees in the D, thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Today we continue marking the 75th anniversary of the 1943 Detroit race riots. Yesterday, Jamon Jordan, tour leader and historian for Black Scroll Network History, told us the story of how the riot began on the Belle Isle Bridge. The following day, June 21st, 1943, thousands of whites began gathering on Woodward Avenue, right around what is now Comerica Park. Jordan picks up the story from there.
Woodward Avenue is one of the major flashpoints of the Detroit race riot in June of 1943. One of the reasons it's the main flashpoint is the borderline between the African-American community, particularly the business district, and the rest of the city of Detroit, which is predominantly white at that time. The other issue is African-Americans are coming back and forth on the streetcars, which are running in the 1940s. And African-Americans are going to work and they're coming home from work on these streetcars. And whites who are part of the rioters, particularly young white men, who are generally the typical rioter is a young white male, they are attacking the streetcars, pulling African Americans off and beating them, and of course in some cases killing them. And so Woodward is a major flashpoint of the violence that is occurring, particularly in this area, which is now a very developed area. You have Comerica Park where the Detroit Tigers play. You have the Little Caesars Arena where the Red Wings and the Detroit Pistons play. Across the street is the Fox Theater. But about a block or two from here, either way, on that side, a block or two, you'd have had the Roxy Theater. In front of the Roxy Theater is where a large amount, numerous people were beaten. In some cases, some people were killed. And of course, there were also numerous arrests by the Detroit Police Department that occurred there. And the Detroit Police Department also engaged in a lot of the brutality as well. So that's all occurring two blocks that way. About two blocks that way is Grand Circus Park, where thousands of people have gathered, number one, to see what's all occurring in this riot, and number two, to find a way to get involved. Many of them are going to head east to Paradise Valley, where they will attack African-American-owned businesses. They will bust out the windows, they will do some looting, they will start a few fires and destroy some of the businesses in the Black Business District of Paradise Valley. So we're kind of in the middle of two major flashpoints during 1943 in June when these Detroit race riots occur. And there's no bones about it. 1943 is a race riot. People argue about 67 of what it was. People may argue about other uprisings that have occurred. But Detroit 1943 is a true race riot. 34 people are killed, 25 African Americans and 9 whites. Out of the African Americans that are killed during the Detroit 1943 race riot, 17 of them are killed by the Detroit Police Department. No whites are killed by the Detroit Police Department. And so we're clearly on a race riot at this point. And some people will maybe even argue it's more racial terror, because it's really mostly one way. Mostly it's African Americans being attacked, arrested and killed, and in most cases, whites who are doing much of the attacking are not being arrested and not being stopped by the Detroit Police Department. So we're at the 75th anniversary of the 1943 race riots, and most people still know very little, next to nothing about it. Most people kind of knew a little bit about 67 when I was coming up, but nobody was talking about 43 but my grandfather. And he would always tell me, it was this real race riot. In 1943, they were pulling people off of the streetcars down in Black Bottom. People were being attacked. And he was telling me about all of that. And I had never heard it from anybody else but him. As I grew up, I learned more about it. But he was the first, and for a long time, the only person that ever mentioned this 43 race riot. I heard about 67 from a number of people, but I had not heard about 43 except from my grandfather.
To hear and see more from Jamon Jordan talking about the 1943 Detroit race riots, you can check out a video our web team put together. Simply go to michiganradio.org. Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Rusty Bruck. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, April Van Buren, Joey Horan, Sarah Leeson, Gabby Horton, and Sophie Sherry. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.